Before I begin, I want to acknowledge what an honor it is to be here today. I'm sure you've heard it from other guests who stood here before me, but it's truly an honor to speak from the same pulpit from which Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King once spoke. It's a little overwhelming, actually. But more than that, even, is the honor to address you. You, a congregation so deeply committed to justice. I know that this congregation is actively engaged in supporting the rights of immigrants and ending the plague of racism in our community and in our country. I know you're right now hosting homeless families here in the church. The recent article in the Inquirer highlighted your efforts, and it made me proud to see a fellow Unitarian Universalist congregation get the recognition that you all deserve. And I want to thank Kent in absentia for his long-standing leadership in all these efforts. His commitment to justice-making has been an inspiration to me for the 14 years that I've known him. And I want to thank Kent for paving the way for me last fall, for making my trip to Tijuana possible. Because before I went to the border in December, Kent was in Tijuana building relationships with individuals and agencies there. He made it possible for me and others to work with Al Otro Lado, an agency supporting asylum seekers. And because I don't speak Spanish, he arranged for a translator to work with me while I was there. I spoke to Kent this morning, and he wanted me to pass along his thanks for all the love and support that you're giving him at this tender time as his father is dying. He said that he feels deeply held and cared for by all of you, and he's sending his love in return. I cannot read Warsan Shire's poem, which I have over and over since I discovered it, without picturing Maria and her six children. I met Maria and her six children in Tijuana last December. They were huddled in the early morning cold, standing in a concrete square just outside the metal gates at the San Ysidro port of entry between the United States and Mexico. I passed through those gates with complete impunity for the week that I was there, but to Maria and her six children, those gates were a monster's mouth with teeth bared. To Maria and her six children, they were completely impenetrable. Maria and her six children, the oldest of whom was just eight and the youngest was an infant in her arms, were scared and confused. They had made the trek to Tijuana from their home country of Honduras as part of that so-called migrant caravan we heard so much about last fall. The, quote, invasion we were told to fear. Maria and her six children had walked most of the way, although for parts of the trip they'd been able to cram themselves onto a crowded truck bed with other asylum seekers. Now, to put their migration journey into perspective, Maria and her six children had walked a distance that's equivalent to walking from here to Los Angeles. Walking with six children, eight and younger. No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. Maria and the two oldest of the six children were carrying tattered plastic shopping bags, the kind of shopping bags that they still are handing out at some supermarkets these days. These bags contained all of their meager personal belongings that they'd brought along with them. And no one would leave home unless home chased you to the shore, unless home told you to quicken your legs, leave your clothes behind. Through my translator, Felix, I learned that Maria was confused. She understood that when she got to the border, she would be able to present herself and her six children to the U.S. authorities and ask for asylum. Legally, I explained to her, she was right. But practically, she wasn't. Felix and I explained that the U.S. government was restricting the daily number of asylum seekers who could apply. And then we explained how other migrants like herself had set up and were administering the process for getting on the list, getting a number, waiting until that number was called. There, we pointed across the square, there is where you wait in line and get your number. We didn't bother to tell Maria and her six children that this limitation and this process were all in violation of international law, because that didn't matter to Maria or her six children who had fled from their home in Honduras and walked the distance from here to Los Angeles. No one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land. No one burns their palms under trains beneath carriages. No one spends days and nights in the stomach of a truck feeding on newspaper unless the miles traveled means something more than journey. After Maria and her six children waited in line with other migrants from Honduras and Guatemala and Nicaragua and Cameroon and Kenya and even a few from Russia, after Maria and her six children had been handed a small scrap of paper with a 4-digit number scrawled on it, Felix and I explained to Maria that she and her six children would need to come back to the plaza by the metal gates that stood like the gaping mouth of a monster, to wait for her number to be called, but that could take weeks or months. We told her that if she missed her number being called, she and her six children would have to get a new number and wait even longer. Then Felix and I, oh, and did I tell you, by the way, that Felix, whose family came to the United States when he was just 5 years old, Felix, my translator, is a veteran of the United States Army who had served honorably, but after his discharge had been deported by our government, even though he had been told that he would be granted citizenship if he served. And that in Tijuana there are about 300 of these so-called green card veterans whom our government has deported. Then Felix and I told Maria and her six children about El Otro Lado. We told her that there were people there who could help her understand what would happen when her number was called, what happened when she passed through the mouth of the monster and entered the asylum process. And we told her about how there were people at El Otro Lado who prepared 2 meals a day that were free for anyone who needed them, no questions asked. We gave Maria a hand-drawn map that showed her how to get to El Otro Lado. Across from the wax museum, we told her. And then we told her that lunch was served at 11:30 and dinner at 5:30. And Maria took my hand in hers and shook it. Gracias, she said, holding my hand in hers. Muchas gracias. And Felix didn't need to translate that for me. And I felt like I had helped, but more than that, I felt angry and ashamed that my country, so full of freedom and opportunity, refused to take in Maria and her six children, 8 and under, who had walked the distance from here to Los Angeles because they feared for their lives. And after Maria shook my hand and thanked me for the meager help that I had offered, Maria and her six children turned away. The children grabbed each other's hands out of habit and fear. They grabbed each other's hands as they no doubt had done for the miles that are the same as between here and Los Angeles, taking each other's hands for safety and security, forming a chain of love and desperation, a chain of hunger and hope that had remained unbroken for that distance that is the same from here to Los Angeles, and they disappeared into the streets of Tijuana. No one leaves home until home is a sweaty voice in your ear saying, leave, run away from me now. I don't know what I've become, but I know that anywhere is safer than here. Brian Stevenson, who is an attorney who has dedicated his life to helping death row inmates, tells us that to work for justice, we need to be prepared to do four things. We need, he says, to get proximate. We need to change the narrative. We need to hold on to hope. And we need to do things that are inconvenient and uncomfortable. By getting proximate, by stepping outside of our own communities of comfort, by getting physically close to those who are oppressed, those who suffer, those whose lives are at risk, we enter into a different kind of relationship with them. Justice making becomes more than an intellectual exercise. It becomes personal and intimate. After my trip to the border, after meeting Maria and her six children and so many others like them, I know exactly what it means to get proximate. Changing the narrative invites us to open ourselves to a new way of seeing those who suffer, not as enemy, not as other, but as fellow human beings, each with a story of their own. The dominant narrative with asylum seekers is about their criminality, their violence, their being a drain on our society and our supposedly limited resources. But there is another story to be told about the fact that immigrants commit crimes at far lower rates than our natural-born citizens, that they pay billions of dollars a year in taxes, even those who are undocumented, that there is no, quote, invasion at our southern border, but a steady stream of mostly women and children whose lives are at risk. We need to change the narrative. And Brian Stevenson reminds us that we cannot afford to feel hopeless. He tells us that we're either hopeful or we're part of the problem. Injustice, he says, prevails where hopelessness persists. Injustice prevails where hopelessness persists. Now, he doesn't have a prescription for inoculating us against hopelessness, but he tells us that being hopeful is our superpower. And I would suggest that we stay hopeful by being in community with other justice seekers, that we find and join communities of hope and courage and compassion where we can add our voice to the chorus singing for justice. We gain hope from each other. We gain hope in communities like this congregation, which is so committed to building the beloved community. And finally, Brian Stevenson says we need to do things that are inconvenient and uncomfortable. We need to stretch to push the edge of our envelope of ease and comfort. It doesn't mean we need to put ourselves at unreasonable risk, but it means we need to be willing, at least temporarily, to leave the safety and security of what we know to find out what we can learn and what we can do. When I went to the border in December, I didn't go live in a shelter with asylum seekers. Each night I crossed back into the safe and comfortable bosom of the United States. I didn't dodge gunshots in Tijuana at night, although I heard some. I ate dinner at a Smashburger. But I did cross that border every morning, traveling back in time almost into an underdeveloped country where poverty and violence are rampant, where I don't speak the language. So it was inconvenient and it was uncomfortable, and it changed me. I desperately want to know where Maria and her six children are at this very moment. Are they still in Tijuana waiting? Was their number called and they're together in detention awaiting an asylum hearing? Are they even still together at all, or have Maria's children been taken from her? Does anyone even know whose children these are or how to reunite them with Maria? Have they, under a cruel policy of this administration, applied for asylum in this country and then been returned to Tijuana, spit back out through the mouth of the monster to await a verdict on their asylum claim? Are they, in the name of migrant protection, as it's called, sitting in a shelter or living on the streets of the murder capital of Mexico, where more than 2,500 people were killed last year? Do they huddle in the fragile safety of a tent city full of other migrants, hoping to avoid the sex traffickers, the gangs, the drug runners who own the streets of Tijuana at night? There are currently some 30,000, think about that number, 30,000 asylum seekers who, under this return to Mexico policy, have been returned to Tijuana and other cities at the border to live in fear for their lives. I pray that Maria and her six children, who walked the distance from here to Los Angeles with just a couple of tattered plastic shopping bags and hope, are among the lucky handful who have been affixed with an ankle monitor and released, dropped off at the San Diego Greyhound terminal without so much as a dime to make a phone call. I pray that Maria and her six children have been taken in by the dedicated and overworked volunteers with the San Diego Rapid Response Network, which provides temporary housing and meals and clothing to asylum seekers, because neither state nor federal nor local assistance is offered to people like Maria and her six children. So let us all pray for Maria and her six children, and for the tens of thousands of men, women, and children like her whose fate is in the hands of our government. But let's not stop with prayer. Let's get proximate. Let's change the narrative. Let's always be hopeful. And let's choose to do something inconvenient or uncomfortable. Because no one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark.